Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 73. My name is Karen. I'm joined by Kristen.
Sup, everyone.
I was like, oh, wow, you know, last week we did the, like, question of the day kind of thing, and I was like, I'm going to start doing that, so we have, like, a little intro where people can get used to our voices, and we have, like, something else to talk about. Totally forgot to do it this week. Like, already dropped the ball 1 week later.
It's March. It's, yeah. It's a giant... I'm not responsible for what March does to my brain.
Yeah.
I feel like February, every year, just goes so fast. Like, it's February 1st, it's February 5th, and then it's February 28th. Like, every year. I lose the middle of that month all the time. It drives me crazy because I'm like, oh, now it's March, and then it's almost April, and then it's May, and then it's summer, and I'm like, where did the year go?
And then it's 2024.
Right?
That's like, what it feels like sometimes.
It just snowballs after that, so yes.
Don't say the S word. The weather is actually, like, kind of nice today.
Yeah, it's going to get cold the rest
of
the week.
No!
Yeah, sorry, that's just...
We've had so many storms, like, especially up in Michigan recently, and I'm tired of it.
I'm ready for it to stop raining. Our yard floods every time it rains.
So does ours. Yeah.
And it's not great.
It's not great. Not at all. Anyway, this is what it's like to be in your 30s. Woo-hoo! And live in a house that you have to take care of.
Wow. It's an adventure.
We're such interesting people.
I know, right?
Every time I'm like, see online when people are like, yeah, I'm an old Percy Jackson fan. I'm 21. I'm like... That's good for you.
Aww.
And I realize that you're not 12, and so you are a bit older.
Yeah.
But, like...
Then there's those of us.
Put me in the retirement home. Anyway, if you would like to tell us how old we are and how boring... I mean, you can. That would be a little mean, but, like... I'll read your email, I guess. You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. I don't know why I held that like it was going to be a surprise.
Top secret email account.
Yeah. We definitely don't have one of those.
It's a Gmail account. Top secret. Spy stuff.
Yes. Spy stuff. So we will be talking about Percy Jackson and the Olympians as a whole this week. But before we do that, we're getting into some news and updates. Not a whole lot going on, if I'm being perfectly honest, which I'm okay with. We just got the Chalice of the Gods cover reveal. I'm still kind of riding high off of that.
Sometimes we have heavy news days. Sometimes we have late days.
Yes. And we're actually going to be talking about Percy Jackson and the Chalice of the Gods again real quick because... Reed Riordan posted about it, and they didn't really have, like, too much more to say than what EW said, but they did have this one line in here. It says, "But trust us, you won't be able to guess what chickens get up to in this story. All we can say is that you'll never look at poultry the same way again." Like, what does that mean?
That bodes well.
Yeah. Will there be immortal chickens? Will there be giant chickens?
Chalice of the Gods...
It turns people immortal. It allows... It grants immortality.
What was the god? It's Ganymede?
Ganymede, yeah.
Does Ganymede have a chicken-related thing?
Well, and we were looking at, like, Minerva and Mars both were related to, like, chickens or roosters.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had that snake thing, too. So, I don't know. I don't know what the chickens could be getting up to. There's only so much a chicken can actually do.
Right.
It's not a very complex
bird. They don't fly.
Bird.
They
yeah.
lay eggs. They can be kind of mean.
They cluck. And cock-a-doodle-do.
If they're male.
Yeah. I don't know.
About all I got.
Yeah. Not sure.
So, yeah. Some Greek chickens are good, you know, seeing them get up to craziness will be interesting.
Yeah. Have to wait till September to find out what the chickens will do. Rick also wrote a blog post. I think that came out potentially later that day or something, because it was outside of when we were recording, since that EW news dropped right then and there.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is kind of a repetition of what was in the EW article, but I did want to mention that UK and international covers will be released soon. The UK edition will also be available on September 26th, which is the same release date as the US publication, but other international on sale dates are currently unknown. I know we do have some international listeners, so I just wanted to mention that for all of you guys. And there will be signed copies available for pre-order. He pretty much always has signed copies available, but he doesn't know when those will happen yet. I don't remember when. I feel like I ordered The Sun and the Star back in, like, October or November. That was, like, 6 months.
Yeah.
So, what's 6 months from September? Be, like, March.
March or April.
Yeah. So, hopefully we'll find out soon.
Yeah. And his are usually through Barnes & Noble, so just kind of keep an eye out.
Yeah.
He uses Barnes & Noble a lot for signed copies. Yeah. So, keep an eye out on their website, too, and they may pop it up there.
Yeah.
Unknown.
So, I feel like he said some variation of this in the past, but this is the first time he's kind of put it exactly like this. He said that this is a standalone for now, but he also says it's one of three ideas that he had for Percy's senior year adventures, which I don't know if he's, like, come out and said that specifically before. So it's possible he could write two more in the future. Depends on his schedule and how well this one does.
Well, didn't we guess at three possible books because it was, like,
well, it was three recommendations.
Right.
Yeah.
From, like, the gods or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, like, it sounds like he wrote this, it stands on its own, it's totally great, but if he has time and or the passion,
yeah,
passion to do it, then he's gonna do it. So, like,
I was trying to figure out what that reminded me of. If anybody has seen the animated Harley Quinn show, have you watched that yet?
I've seen, I think, one of the movies. I don't think I've seen the show.
Okay, yeah. The show's very good, but Clayface, he talks like that all the time, and it was a very good impression of him that you just did on accident. It was great.
Fabulous.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty cool. I feel like this book's going to be successful. Everybody's very excited about it, unless he, like, totally jumps the shark or something like that. Right. I feel like everybody's going to like it. It's just going to depend on his schedule and the adaptations. We know that not only is he working on the show and the King Chronicles movies, but he's also still thinking about Magnus Chase. He's still thinking about the Irish adaptation, like
Daughter of the Deep.
Yeah, like, he's got a lot of stuff going on still, so.
Not to mention, I don't know if he's at all involved in any of this spinoff, or the Reed Riordan. Yes. The Rick Riordan Presents authors, shows, and things.
Because he has his own production company, so I was wondering if he would kind of,
or even just as, like, an advisor, or, like, kind of helping them through it, because now he's gone through it terribly once, and he's in the process of kind of going through a really great adaptation, and so he kind of has some knowledge and advice to give. So, yeah, that makes me wonder if he may be involved in, like, the R.O. Shaw adaptation or some of the other ones that we've heard.
I guess it just depends on how much time he has.
Truly.
And I don't know, like, I mean, obviously, production companies can be all different sizes. I don't know how big his production company actually is, if they've got their own, like, employees and people, or if it's literally just Rick and Becky as, like, executive producers being like, this is, you know, the company that we own, that we are a part of, to kind of, like, put their name on stuff.
Right, like, for non-book-related media, this is the Rick Riordan production imprint.
Yeah.
Like, this is what we put on anything that we're working on, you know.
Yeah.
No, you're definitely, yeah.
But, I mean, it would be really cool if they could help produce the other adaptations, because I think that those other adaptations would happen much faster if
probably
that were the case. I want to say right now, not to get too much off track, but I think Paula Santiago is the one that's moving forward the most, from what I remember.
Okay.
I think that one's, like
the fastest.
Yeah, I think that one's, like, the most concrete adaptation that's going on right now, because I don't know if our Shaw is getting, like, picked back up or, like, no. what's actually going on with that, but...
Sometimes the option expires and someone else will pick it up, but yeah. they have to wait until, like, if Disney has the option on it because they published the book, mm-hmm. then, like, they have to, you know, if they're gonna make the series, they have a certain amount of time to get started on it before yeah. the option expires. So, yeah, like... It's possible that maybe they just don't have time for it.
I think Disney should just adapt all of those books. They can be animated, but, like, kids would eat that stuff up. I think a lot of people would. And, I mean, there's a lot of adults who love animation, like The Dragon Prince and Avatar The Last Airbender. Like, those are still popular amongst adults.
And, like, I know animation takes a lot longer than traditional filming. Like, mm-hmm. it does take longer to produce the series, the show, the episodes, or whatever. But... considering that I am always looking for new stuff and Disney Plus feels like it never has, like, new shows or new whatever, like, even if it was a Disney Plus show and just a Disney Plus show, like, Percy's going to be,
yeah.
like, I feel like these would do so well, you know? Like, I feel like parents would love to have their kids, you know,
yeah.
just not have to worry about it and all of that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's... hopefully. Hopefully we'll get all of them.
Yeah, I would really like it. Speaking of Magnus, though, Reed Riordan also put up another OTP Timelines article. Magnus Chase and Alex Fierro, which is super awesome. It came with new artwork that's really quite cute. And it's just, you know, like the other ones, kind of going through the timeline of how they met and their relationship and all of that. I love Magnus Chase so much, but it's been a while since I've read it, and so I'm... It's going to take us a while to get to it, but, like, I'm really excited for it when we do.
There's definitely a lot of those books that I do not remember.
Yeah.
Like, I know I read them, and I enjoyed them, and, you know, but I, yeah, there's so much of it that is just gone.
Yeah.
that I'm very interested to revisit those eventually, yeah. so yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah. I also just wanted to shout out a couple of books by Rick Riordan Presents authors that aren't under the imprint but are either just came out or are coming out soon, because I don't think I mentioned last week, The Last Tale of the Flower Bride by Roshni Chokshi is out now. I did write a review for it on Subjectify Media. It is an interesting book. It's kind of an ode to, like, fairy tales and stories in general, mythology. It's an adult book. It is pretty dark, and, you know, if that's your thing, then I think you're gonna enjoy it. You can check out my spoiler-free review and see if it's something that interests you. And then I also wanted to remind everyone that Lucha of the Night Forest by Taylor K. Mejia comes out March 21st. Also, Taylor has started going by they-them pronouns, so I wanted to mention that. And Into the Light by Mark Ishiro comes out March 28th. Into the Light has been getting so many rave reviews. I'm really, really excited to read that. But also, Lucha of the Night Forest is, like, definitely my kind of book, so also very excited for that. I will have reviews for both of them on Subjectify Media, hopefully on publication day. We'll see. I did not read all my February books, so I'm a little behind, but we're working on it. We'll get it done.
Yeah.
At some point.
It's all good, trust me, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just jump into our discussion for today. This is pretty much all we're going to be talking about today, because I feel like talking about the series as a whole should kind of stand on its own. You know, we don't have a double discussion, which is totally fine. And I just kind of wanted to do this little, like, retrospective in terms of the books. And it feels weird on the one hand, because I'm like, we just read them. But on the other hand, like, The Lightning Thief was, like, a year and a half ago when we had started that. So yep. I just wanted to take a really quick look back at the series, book by book, and then we can kind of share our feelings as we do. So The Lightning Thief, you know... I think everybody remembers what happens in The Lightning Thief, but, you know, Zeus thinks Percy steals his master bolt. He and Grover and Annabeth have to go on a road trip to prove his innocence. And I think that this, like, the road trip aspect of this book is, like, a really... I've always really liked that about it, because it kind of gives you, like, these destinations, and, you know, you're trying to make your way to the end goal. Like, it's a very streamlined book, and I feel like that, like, as much as we don't like the movie, the way that they did it with, like, getting each pearl and stuff like that, I always really liked that part of it, even though they changed it from the book. I just feel like it's your typical quest story, and I think it's very classic.
Well, instead of it being like, okay, we're just trying to get from A to B, and here's all the monsters we meet along the way, they just changed it to, we have things we need to collect, we must make it to each of these places. Mm-hmm. Which, again, it's a little change, but it's not, like, a massive change to the story, so it works, it's fine. But, yeah, I do like this kind of blueprint for a Rick book, because I feel like we kind of get back to this a little bit in Titan's Curse.
Mm.
Sea of Monsters is a little left of center for this, because it's not a true quest that Percy is on, because he's not really a part of the initial questing group for
the official questing
group for Sea of Monsters. He kind of just shows up and helps out.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, I like that we do kind of get a format for here's how these quests kind of go, in you know, just generally in story form, not necessarily strict rules or anything.
Right. But there's usually, like, a timetable, there's usually an end destination, there's usually shenanigans along the way.
There's monsters along the way, it's not just from train to plane to, you know, bus and we're there. Like, no, it's... Yeah, so I do really like, I think that Lightning Thief does a really good job of kind of setting that up, getting us accustomed to how Rick, like, tells a story, and it works really well.
And it gets us accustomed to the world, too, to Camp Half-Blood. We see that for the first time, and we learn about Greek gods, we learn that they're real right alongside Percy and the monsters, and just how the world works in general. And, you know, Sally gets stolen. That's kind of a big deal in this story. And the trio bonds. Grover and Percy are friends, and Grover and Annabeth are friends, but Annabeth and Percy aren't friends, and the three of them aren't friends as, like, a group until the end of this book, because they went through so much while they did it. But I think that The Lightning Thief does such a good job of explaining the rules of the story without, like, overwhelming you with exposition, and having him go up against some scary creatures, and, you know, it's still funny. Like, I think that The Lightning Thief is kind of the total package for me, and Rick does a really good job of, like, opening the door to this world.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's a really good start-to-finish story that if some idiot publisher decided, I don't want to be in the Rick Riordan business... If it had ended there, it would have been a good, solid story.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's clearly more, because I think we get hints of the Great Prophecy and other things in that book.
Yeah.
But,
and,
like,
Luke at the end kind of tells you that there's more to come.
Yeah. But, like, if it had to have ended there, it would have been a complete story. We would have felt pretty satisfied. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I'm really, really glad that it went on to be, like,
Sally back,
nine,
like,
more books.
Yeah.
An extra four.
He kind of does what he sets out to do in the first book. So you're right, it is kind of a closed story, even though there's definitely room for more.
Yeah.
And then I always remember, like, you know, these are our babies. They're 12 years old in The Lightning Thief. They're so young. They have to save the future of Olympus. They have to make sure that the Greek gods don't tear each other apart. So basically, they're saving the world, and it's just, it's a lot for them to go through, and unfortunately, it really doesn't get better from there. Like, it gets scarier sometimes from there, but...
Yep, and definitely more complicated.
Yeah, but they handle it pretty well, all things considered.
Yep.
And then, of course, like I said, by the end, we find out Luke is definitely not their friend, so that's a pretty big twist to that first book. And then we get into the Sea of Monsters. In this one, Grover gets kidnapped while out searching for Pan, and the trio, plus Clarice, has to go save him. And so you're right, like, it's not really the typical quest like the first one is, because Percy's not supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Grover.
He's a bonus demigod.
Yeah. But it's Grover. He wasn't not going to save his best friend.
Right.
This book also introduces Tyson and Talia, and we get more of Annabeth's backstory with all of that, and her complicated feelings about hanging out with a Cyclops, and I feel like this does a lot of heavy lifting for Annabeth specifically, but also Clarice. You know, we get to see a different side of Clarice in this book, too.
Yeah, this book like, if the first one was laying the groundwork, getting us used to the world, getting us used to how these stories are going to kind of go, like, get a general feel for it, Sea of Monsters goes a long way to, like, getting to the heart of the characters.
Yeah.
We learn a lot about Annabeth from both the sirens and the thing, you know, while Percy's there and, like, the guinea pig thing is a little bit eye-opening as well, but like we learn quite a bit about Grover between from the empathy link and like all of that, and we learn a lot about Clarice. We learn quite a bit about Percy and his power and, you know, him being able to steer the ship without even really thinking about it.
Right.
Like, there's so much that we learn in that book about the characters that then of course pushes the next three books forward, because like we don't have as much time to get into our main trio and their wants and needs when we've got, you know, Titan's Curse, we've got Zoe and all of them along for the ride. Then you get to Battle of the Labyrinth, where the Labyrinth is a giant character all itself that you're trying to navigate that. And then it's Last Olympian and you're in battle and you're saving the world. So, like, this book, I think, Sea of Monsters is the one that kind of just drives home who these characters are and get us really well acquainted so that we know how they will react and how we can kind of guess how things are going to go for them based, you know, with what happens after this.
Yeah, that's totally true. And, you know, this is why I wanted to do this, because, like, while you're reading Sea of Monsters, like, you realize, oh, I'm getting a lot more information about Annabeth. But when you kind of pull back and look at the books overall, you can see the purpose of each one, and I think Sea of Monsters really has a lot to do with Percy and Annabeth specifically, and I think that a lot of that has to do with Tyson's introduction, because neither one of them are very happy with Tyson when he's first introduced. Like, Annabeth obviously has her own prejudices, and Percy feels kind of weird that he has a Cyclops for a half-brother, you know? Like, he's not super thrilled about that, but Tyson really proves his worth in so many different ways, and I know he's a favorite character for us, and so it's just so nice. You know, his introduction, his origin is a bit sad, but as you see him grow throughout the books, like, you see how well he's done for himself and how he's become, if not, you know, like, part of the main trio, obviously, but, like, definitely a huge secondary character.
Yeah, and his role in Percy's life definitely changes Percy's, like, outlook on things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he...
And Annabeth's, too.
Absolutely. And, like, Tyson really goes a long way to making Percy a better person. Like, you know, at first he's just kind of taken aback by it and kind of like, you know, it's kind of obnoxious to have your little brother, your little big brother, kind of tailing after you all the time and driving him crazy. But like, he quickly kind of sees Tyson's value, and as Sea of Monsters and then, you know, other in the later books as well, he quickly learns just how useful and wonderful Tyson is to have, not just as a brother, but like as a friend and as someone who can, you know, be alongside for these adventures and be a valuable asset to the team. So that is another thing I will always love Sea of Monsters for, is giving us Tyson.
I think it's so great too that Tyson is just such a genuine character. Like, he really wears his heart on his sleeve. He's very open and vulnerable all of the time with his emotions and his love. And I think if it were anybody else, there probably would have been a little bit more between all of them. Like, it would have been a little bit more of a struggle. But, like, you can't not love Tyson. Like, it's just so easy to love Tyson.
Yeah.
He's so great.
He is.
But jumping into the Titan's Curse now, Annabeth basically gets stolen by Atlas's minion and is gone for most of this book. And it's basically like Percy's job. He makes it his job to go get her back. And so we see them, you know, him and Grover team up with the Hunters of Artemis. And that's a whole thing. Talia joins the Hunters. We meet Zoe, like you were talking about. And I think we get like this whole other world within a world when we meet the Hunters, because they're so different. They're immortal kind of, mostly.
Yeah.
Not totally, but more so than Percy is.
Yeah.
And we actually get to see Artemis up close and personal, too, which up until this point, like, we've definitely seen the gods, but I think we meet Artemis on a level that's a little bit more equal than when he meets some of the other gods.
She, like, a handful of other gods, I would include Dionysus in this group, is, yeah, like, they're approachable. They're, yeah, they're
which
not...
is funny when you're considering Mr. Right. D.
But it's because they, like, spend time on Earth. All, yeah, of the other gods, like, they may deign to visit Earth, but, you know, when he meets Hermes or meets Caesar's dad or Ares pops up to make trouble, like, we think of them as Olympian gods, and, yeah, they're in their throne room all the time, and then occasionally they pop down to make trouble or to help or, yeah, whatever.
Or both at the same,
right,
time.
Right, exactly. Whereas I feel like Artemis spends the majority of her time on Earth. Mr. D has been cursed to stay on Earth for the time being in camp, drinking Diet Coke.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, so I feel like there's two different, like, classes of gods for me. It's, there's the ones that are up there, and then there's, like, the approachable ones, the ones, you know, include Hestia in that group, because,
yeah,
she literally spends time in the throne room, yes, but also, like, around the hearth, mm-hmm, at Camp Half-Blood and elsewhere, so it's just not quite so intimidating.
Yeah, all of those gods that you mentioned have an understanding of humanity in, like, a day-to-day life kind of situation, where I think it does make them more approachable, and you can talk to them like they're people, even though they never really let you forget that they're gods. But I think that, yeah, approachable is just the word I keep coming back to. Like, it's just a more equal level versus, like, Zeus, who never really... Do we see him come down to Earth?
I'm trying to remember if in Heroes of Olympus we do, because he doesn't in Percy,
yeah,
Jackson
we
in the Olympians.
We only see him in the throne room, and then, like, he's obviously out fighting Typhon,
right,
but, like...
Right. But I don't think we ever see him on Earth like we do Poseidon, like we,
yeah,
do Hermes, like
just
we do...
Just visiting, you,
right,
know, his kids or something,
right,
like that.
Yeah, I don't think we do. At least not that I remember. I'm pretty certain I can say for the original five books he does not, because I do not remember,
yeah,
that, and we just
We even see
them.
Athena on Earth.
Right.
And she's also one of those that, like, even though I like her, she's a bit loftier than...
Aloof.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I will say, I think Apollo perfectly fits between those two.
Yes, I
He's
agree.
The exception.
Yeah.
Because he is Apollo. Like, he's the god, you know. And
he never
does,
lets you forget it.
Right. And he does have some scary power that,
yeah,
you know. But then he's also Mr. Surfer Dude Extraordinaire, who's really happy to take you on a trip, you know, across the sky. And
Sun
whatever.
Chariot.
Right. Like, he's very approachable, but he also has, like, a bit of that powerful aura thing that makes him one of the big ones.
Yeah.
So, like, I think Apollo is a good illustration of someone who fits right between them, but for the majority, I'd say it's one or the other.
Yeah. Now I just want to, like, because I'm a nerd, build, like, some scale or chart that's, like, approachable on one end, aloof on the other, and then, like, rank all of the gods according to which ones you'd actually, like, want to talk to.
Basically, like, Artemis to Zeus.
Yeah.
Because I feel like Zeus is probably the extreme. I don't want to ever deign to be near
I couldn't
people.
Decide if Artemis or Mr. D would be at the end.
Right. It's
yeah.
it's a hard call. Hard call. I have to say, and we have some, we're definitely going to talk about some of our favorite things in a little bit, but this Titan's Curse is probably my least favorite book.
No!
And it's not because it's a bad story. I love the Hunters. I love Zoe. I honestly love, like, the complicated relationship that she has with her family and how that all unfolds. Like, it's really good. But I think it's the fact that the trio is separated,
yeah,
for so much of this book.
Yeah.
And it's not just the trio is separated. It's Annabeth. I... Not having her in so much of this book hurts for me. Like, it,
yeah,
really just hurts my enjoyment of it. Again, still a great story, still totally worth reading, but it just, if I'm ranking them on a, you know, a very high pedestal, because I love these books, I think Titan's Curse would probably be my last place.
Oh, okay. I've actually thought long and hard about my least favorite book, and mine's The Last Olympian. I'm really quite frustrated with a lot of things that happen in that book, and I know people love it. Like, people really, really love that book, and I feel bad saying that. I mean, again, it's still a great book,
right?
And there are moments in it that are just so iconic, but I think that the small details that I don't like just add up enough that I think that one might be my least favorite.
Very interesting.
I really love Titan's Curse. But I understand where you're coming from, and I keep thinking about the show and just how much I'm like, if they can just show us Annabeth in the show, if they can show us what's happening with Luke and the army and everything, then that will be such a bigger, fuller picture, and I really wouldn't mind, like, seeing that. I think it could round out the story in a way that, unfortunately, the book wasn't able to do because it is all from Percy's point of view.
Right. And I feel like this is a bit, especially because Sea of Monsters, we get a bit of it with Grover being separated from Percy and Annabeth. But because of the empathy link, we have these check-ins with Percy all the time. So you don't feel like Grover's that far away. Like, he's technically far away at some points, but, like, he's still attached to Percy. We still have, you know, have check-ins. We see what he's doing, and we feel better. So, yeah, I feel like the show may be able to make Titan's Curse more, like, I may be more fond of the show's interpretation of it because we'll get some doses of Annabeth. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to be Annabeth with Percy. It's just we go so long in that book without knowing how she is, what's going on, where she is. You know, we get one or two little check-ins, but it's
like
usually
the dreams and stuff. Yeah.
But, like, we don't have a clear picture of what's happening.
It's meant
to
be mysterious.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, totally fine. But, like, it just, yeah, it hurts my enjoyment of the book. So I do think the show may go a long way to making this a story that I'm more attached to.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I was just thinking about, like, the first book is obviously, like, the trio. They're all together. Second book, Grover's gone for a big chunk of it. Third book, Annabeth's gone for a big chunk of it. Fourth book, Grover's kind of gone again because him and Tyson are out looking for Pan.
Yeah, so halfway through they
take off. We have, like, Annabeth and Percy there and Rachel. And then the fifth book, Annabeth kind of steps away for a little bit because her and Percy are fighting. So I never realized that pattern before. I wonder if that was, like, a conscious thing where he was, like, got to take somebody away for a little bit, like, focus more on Percy and what he's doing.
Yeah.
I don't know. So then when you think about it, when we do get Chalice of the Gods and it is the trio again.
Yeah.
That's going to kind of be, I mean, obviously they were together throughout the other books at different times, but it might be the most they're together since The Lightning Thief.
Yeah. I mean, with the exception of their time together at camp, which we only get brief glimpses of because the story is outside of camp usually. But yeah, like, as far as the books go, I think it will be the most time we see the three of them together since the original.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously this is also Nico's introduction. When we were looking at quotes to pick for, like, our favorite quotes, I saw the one that was like 3,000 attack power and all that stuff, and I'm like, oh, poor innocent baby Nico. He was so happy and cute. And, you know, even though we don't see him a lot in this book, we do, like, it is his introduction, and obviously his entire world changes because we also get Bianca's introduction and her goodbye all in the same book. Yeah, that was pretty rough, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. It's definitely one of the more downer parts of this series.
I always think of Titan's Curse, maybe it's because of the cover, but, like, that book is just blue to me.
Yeah.
Blue and white are the colors that I associate with that book, and it's just, it's a very sad, cold book.
Yeah.
Also, it takes place during winter, so that does make sense.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not completely out there.
Yeah. So, then we have Battle of the Labyrinth. This is the fourth book, obviously. The trio has to conquer the labyrinth in order to stop Cronus' army from using it. Percy and Annabeth are not on the same page here, especially with Rachel around and especially when it comes to Luke. That's kind of, both of those people are the reason why they're kind of, like, fighting throughout this book. And like you said before, the Labyrinth is its own character. In this book, they spend a good amount of time kind of trying to find their way through it. We get the whole Pan storyline here as well. We see Hera. She comes down to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would put her pretty far to Zeus's level of aloof, though, because she is not a nice lady.
Yep, just barely not on the end.
Yeah. And we meet Quintus, who turns out to be Daedalus, and also Mrs. O'Leary.
Aww,
yeah, so cute. So, yeah, I mean, the Labyrinth and the places that they get to go because of the Labyrinth, like the ranch really stands out in my mind here, and just them trying to find Daedalus's workshop. This book is very dynamic, and I kind of always picture, like, these moving parts because the Labyrinth is constantly moving around and stuff.
Yeah, the Underground Coliseum pops out to me, where they, like, fight the...
Right, the other...
The game show bad... Yeah, yeah, like, all that stuff. It's a crazy book, because you literally can be anywhere at any time doing just about anything.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of the Labyrinth, there's no... Like, the physics of getting from San Fran to New York, like, they can be anywhere at any point. And so it makes it really easy, I'm sure, to kind of tell that story, because you can literally just make your characters show up wherever you want them to be, because that's how the Labyrinth works. Because the Labyrinth is such a character, I feel like we spend a little more time kind of understanding the Labyrinth and what it wants, and it brings us to see certain qualities in our characters, but for the most part, I think the Labyrinth takes center stage in that book. As much as, like, I love the characters.
And, yeah.
Yeah. But I feel like so much of that book is trying to drive home or figure out what the Labyrinth is doing, why it's taking them where it's taking them, how they can possibly get through it. Like, we learn things about our heroes along the way, but the Labyrinth is such a huge presence in that book.
Yeah. I completely agree, and I, you know, the Labyrinth is a world within a world, and that's so interesting in this already complex and very full world upon the surface to, you know, have this whole other world down below, and you get the added benefit of Rachel's introduction, like the weird things that are going on with her, and we kind of get to come face to face a little bit more with Luke and what that could possibly mean. And, of course, we still have the Nico storyline, because in this book, Nico has a lot of feelings about Percy and his sister's death. But he does ultimately team up with the trio, and I'm very proud of Nico for kind of coming to that on his own. Like, he knew he wanted revenge on Percy, but he also kind of knew right from wrong enough to, like, not give in to that as much as Minos wanted him to. So I think that he sees a lot of growth in this book as well, which is pretty cool considering there's a lot going on in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
To give him his own arc, too.
Yeah. It's definitely, I would say, the most dense of all of them because, you know, Lightning Thief, it's pretty straightforward what's going on. Sea of Monsters, there's a little more going on with, you know, Percy not being on the quest and all of that. Titan's Curse, where's Annabeth? It's a looming mystery, but the Battle of the Labyrinth, again, there's just so much to it with the Labyrinth itself that, yeah, I think it's the most dense of the stories, trying to navigate all of the different relationships with Annabeth and Luke and Percy and Rachel and then Grover when he's around. And it really just has so much going on that it's definitely, the densest of all of them.
I would definitely agree with that. And then, obviously, the book also ends on this battle at Camp Half-Blood where, you know, unfortunately some people do die and a lot of monsters are defeated as well, but it's like, it's definitely this precursor to The Last Olympian where you're like, okay, this is, like, real now. Like, we're having battles, people are dying, we have to use our powers. It's a bit scary.
Yeah, and you know, just thinking about it now, like, can you imagine if they hadn't had the battle at Camp Half-Blood, how much stronger Kronos would have been, like, to have all of those monsters on top of what he had in Manhattan at his disposal? Mm-hmm. Like, it might have been overwhelming. They may not have been able to stop him. But because they were able to decimate his forces so much at Camp Half-Blood. I think it went a long way to helping them.
Yeah, and I think it also opened the eyes of the campers to, like, okay, this is happening. Like, now we kind of know what we're up against, and they're, like, taking it more seriously than I think maybe they would have otherwise.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's kind of a horrible eye-opening experience, but
yeah,
ultimately I think it was better for them. And then we move right into The Last Olympian, the final book in the original series. And the trio, you know, learns more about Luke's past as they prepare to face him as Luke Chronos, or the Luke Chrysalis, whichever one that you prefer. I'm so very proud of that one.
It is a good one.
It's pretty great. And I will say that, like, there's a lot of backstory in this book. There's a lot of... Is it exposition? I mean, I feel like exposition implies, like, present tense almost.
Yeah, yeah.
It's backstory.
It is. It's learning what... We're taking a step back to see how Luke got to where Luke is. So, yeah, it's backstory. It is expositional. It's expository. I don't know. One of those words. Like, it is very dense, and you're looking at all of this stuff that you have to learn about Luke in order for the end to really feel like a payoff. You have to know what happened to get him to this point,
right,
how, you know, how he got there, and you have to feel for him.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have some sort of sympathy for him. Otherwise, by the end, you won't care.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we spend a lot of this book getting into what makes Luke Luke, mm-hmm, and why he is where he is and how he got there.
And his relationship with Hermes and Hermes's role in it. And even, like, Hades's role and the curse with Rachel and everything like that. Like, mm-hmm, all of that is kind of tied up together.
Yep.
And then the other part of the book is the Battle of Manhattan. You know, that's, like, half that book. It's,
yeah,
this battle, which I remember talking about, like, really liking that because I think it made it more realistic. And it stayed interesting the entire time, like going up against the different people, losing certain campers, the meeting with Prometheus and all of that, you know, like there's a lot going on in this book. And then, of course, we get that final confrontation with Luke Chronos and Percy's defeat of him with the trio. We talked a lot about kind of coming full circle and having them together again, and then Ethan Nakamura being there and the implications of all of that. And then ultimately Percy's decision to turn down immortality and what will happen because he asked the gods to be better parents, basically. Children shouldn't have to ask their parents to be better parents.
Nope.
Just saying.
Nope.
But it does work out in the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still feel kind of guilty saying this is my least favorite book. But I think that the back half of it, especially where we get into the stakes of the battle and we get into this final confrontation, it's very good. And it ties up a lot of loose ends. There's plenty of callbacks back to that first book. It just, everything kind of comes full circle. And I think that it's a very well-written book in terms of that in particular.
I will say, I'm a big fan of, throughout the Battle of Manhattan, Rick does a very good job of giving landmarks for things in the city to make it really, like, easily identifiable. Like, the bridge is obviously, like, you can go visit it, you can go walk across it, you can pretend you're Percy and stand, yeah, in the middle.
don't do that.
Right. But, no, but you can, like, you can picture, like, the library and the lion statues, and you can picture hanging out near the Empire State Building or, like, the five blocks around the Empire State Building and, like, them holding off forces. Like, he does a really good job of giving you kind of a very quick glance overview of what makes Manhattan the perfect place for Chronos to attack, but also somewhere that they actually might be able to defend because the Empire State Building is in the middle and they have to, you know, like, it's, there are ways to defend it. They just have to be smart about it. So, mm-hmm, like, I really do like that aspect of the Battle of Manhattan, too, that, like, we get a really good idea of the physicality of it. Plus, so many of the other books, the locations are all over the place. In Battle of Manhattan, we're in one place for a long time.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you wanted to go and walk around Manhattan, you could spend a day, maybe two, wandering around and kind of visiting these specific locations and kind of thinking about how, you know, if it actually unfolded, like, how things would feel and look and whatever. So, like, yeah, it's, I think that's why Last Olympian kind of ranks a little higher for me, is because it just, there's something so visceral and real about it, because I've been there and I kind of have an idea of what it looks like and I can feel it a little
more. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess, well, last thing with this is Persepeth is a go.
Yes.
We just spent an entire episode on that, so I don't think we really have to rehash that. You can go listen to episode 72 right. if you want to hear us gush about Persepeth. But that brings us to my biggest question, really, because I spent a very long time thinking about this. What book is your favorite and why?
It's a really, it's not an easy question.
It's not.
I definitely took some time and kind of, like, weighed it out and thought about which of these, like, stands out to me, which story I like the best. And for me, my favorite is Sea of Monsters, which is probably predictable after last week and some of the moments I picked out of Sea of Monsters, because it's so character-centric, because we really get into what makes Annabeth Annabeth, and it's not just like he tells us, here's why Annabeth, you know, is this way. No. Instead, we get to see things that, you know, we get to see why she's ambitious. We get to see what her biggest dreams are, you know, having her family by her side and also being able to, you know, build massive parts of the New York skyline. And, like, we learn her fatal flaw. And we, you know, there's so much that he just lets us kind of into her head, and we look around and we get to see what makes Annabeth tick.
Mm-hmm. And it's all part of the plot. Like, it's, like you were saying, he doesn't just tell us. Like, it comes out because of what happens in the story, which is a really good way to, like, show who your characters are.
Yeah, and, like, it's a thing in, like, TV and movies to show, not tell. Like, they tell you not to, you know, expressly describe to every minute detail what's going on in the scene so that you give it to your audience. You want them to look at the scenario, to look at the scene, and to feel what you want them to feel, but, like, everyone's going to get something slightly different out of the image they're looking at. And I feel like Rick kind of takes a bit of that in Sea of Monsters, because he doesn't flat out just tell us everything we need to know. We get a glimpse of Percy as this seafaring badass who can steer pirate ships without even blinking and, you know, is able to save Annabeth from herself when she has, you know, her weak moment. But, like, yeah, I also love that we get to see and know Clarice. After the first book, she's kind of set up as an antagonist, but in this book, she turns from being an antagonist into a part of the group?
A reluctant ally? Yeah.
Yeah, like, she's definitely starting to bond with Annabeth. She's still doesn't like Percy that much, but it's more of, like, a sibling-esque bickering relationship than it is true hate. And, like, yeah, there's just so much in Sea of Monsters that I feel like gives us a nice, deep view into all of their heads and kind of what makes each of them tick. And yeah. I think that's why it's my favorite.
Yeah. I can totally see that. I mean, like you said, it's very difficult to pick a favorite book because they're so different in a lot of ways, and there's so many reasons to like all of them. I will say that I think my favorite book is going to be Battle of the Labyrinth, because I mean, as much as I do love the character stuff, I think Battle of the Labyrinth is very dynamic and action-packed, and that's usually my jam. We're kind of deeper into the story in terms of, like, we know these characters pretty well, we know the world pretty well, and Rick is adding layers and layers with the labyrinth and with, you know, the complexity of Percy's relationship with Annabeth, where, like, I feel like they know that they like each other, but there's this thing with Rachel that comes in, there's this thing with Luke that comes in. And it, you know, they're not quite ready to get together yet because they have a lot of things to work out. And with Kronos rising and Luke kind of being in the middle of it, like, it's just, everything's so dangerous. And and the mystery with Quintus, you know, like, there's so much there to kind of dig into. And those are the stories. Like you said, it's a very dense book. It's probably the densest of all of them, and I think that's why I gravitate toward that one. That being said, I feel bad not saying The Lightning Thief is my favorite because it's so iconic. Yeah. And it's just that introductory book where it's like, this is what hooked me on the series. This is what introduced me to Percy and Annabeth and Grover and the whole world. And it's hard not to be like, I mean, it's the first one. Like, you kind of always like the first movie in a series the best, you know? That's the thing that, like, really grabbed your attention and made you a fan. Even if you like the sequels, it always kind of goes back to that first one. So
I think some of the reason why Lightning Thief isn't the story that I, like, would call my favorite, it might have something to do with it being the story from this series that's been retold the most times.
Yeah.
I've listened to the audiobook. I've read the book. I've looked at the graphic novel. I've seen the musical. I've watched the movie. And now I'm going to watch the show.
Yeah.
So, like, we've seen so much of that story over and over again just because it's the beginning. It's, you can't do a series of movies without doing the first movie.
Right.
You can't do a new Percy Jackson series without doing The Lightning Thief first. You can't have a Percy Jackson musical and just not touch The Lightning Thief.
Yeah.
Like, it's the story you tell. So it makes total sense. But I think because we've spent so much time with it, it's like, okay, the other stories have special moments and things that we haven't seen unfold yet. You know, even Sea of Monsters movie misses so much of what makes Sea of Monsters Sea of Monsters for me that, like, I feel like I still haven't really seen it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like, I feel like that might be a part of why Lightning Thief doesn't necessarily rank at the top of my list. It's just because it's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's overexposed.
That's so funny because I think I feel the opposite for, like, the same reason. Like, that we've seen it so many times. It's so iconic that the story is so classic at this point that it's like, there's a reason why people keep going back to it. Why it got movie adaptations and a musical adaptation and a graphic novel adaptation and all of that. But, I mean, I totally see your point, and I think that holds true in a lot of ways. And again, I'm very curious to see what the show will do with it to make this a new experience. And I'm actually going to be very interested to hear what you have to say about that because, you know,
trust me, I'm more than excited to revisit Lightning Thief again. Especially because I am intrigued more than anything to see how Rick wants it done.
Yeah.
Like, his hands are all over this pie. So I am not at all worried about it being a different, you know, a weird interpretation. Or, you know, he didn't really have a hand in the musical or the movie.
Right.
The musical had his blessing, but wasn't necessarily something he helped create. So, like, it has some characterizations and things that he may not kind of see. He appreciates it, but he doesn't, like, necessarily, it's not how he saw the character or how he saw the story unfolding. So I'm really, really excited to see his vision for a visual representation of his book. Because it's going to be, I mean, it's the ultimate adaptation for me. All of the others are great, but this will be the ultimate.
Yeah. And it helps that it's a TV show because you have so much more time to explore that.
Yeah.
So
I think that's also definitely going to help.
Yeah.
Having an entire season to tell the story as opposed to, like, 2 hours, it's going to really touch on so many of the things that make us fall in love with these books. The wit and the funny and the silly little moments and, all of that.
Yeah, definitely. So, which is your favorite character and why?
Okay, so, I mean, I basically picked a main character and then, like, a peripheral character.
Okay.
Because there's too many. Main character-wise, it's funny enough, I actually think Percy is my favorite character.
Okay.
I love Annabeth. I love Grover. Percy, for some reason, and this is not normal for me, I usually like one of the main trio. It's never the actual, like, protagonist.
I've had this discussion with people in the past where a lot of the times I don't think that you tend to like, people in general don't like the main character because it's you. You are the main character. Like, you put yourself in their shoes and you're privy to a lot of their thoughts, which, you know, could definitely steer... Keep going back to Harry Potter. Like, yeah, you know, Harry,
it's hard not to.
You see him being a brat, you see him judging people, and also, like, he's your window into this world, so, like, you tend to like other characters that aren't the main character. Like, Hermione was always my favorite because I connected with her a lot.
And same.
Yeah, so yeah. I totally get that. But I think you're right. I think Percy kind of tends to be the exception to this rule.
Yeah, he... There's so much that makes Percy Percy that I think makes him the most relatable for me of the trio.
Yeah.
Grover is... I love him to death, but he's a major departure from, like... someone I would, like, relate to.
Yeah.
You know. I just don't care about the wild at all. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking. That was a joke.
I was gonna judge you. I was like, wow, Kristen.
I'm totally kidding. No, he's just, you know, he's a satyr. And that changes the whole perspective of what's important to him. And it makes him the hardest for me to kind of completely relate to. Obviously, I'm gonna relate to Annabeth. Mm-hmm. She's... the girl in the situation, in the trio, and it's really easy for me to kind of see how we relate. But with Percy, he is really willing to admit that he doesn't know everything,
mm-hmm.
which is really admirable for a main protagonist character. Like, I feel like Harry Potter, he doesn't want to admit that he doesn't know stuff. Mm-hmm. So he pretends to know stuff and gets himself in trouble because he pretends to know stuff.
Yeah.
Percy, for the most part, gets in trouble because he's a demigod. There's nothing he can do about it.
Yeah.
Trouble finds him whether he wants it or not. So he's not afraid to be like, I don't know what to do. Annabeth, you know more about this. Tell me how to save us. Tell me what I can do. Help me figure this out. Grover, you know, what's going on? How do I handle this? So I think Percy being willing to admit he's not the be-all, end-all, he needs Annabeth, he needs Grover, he needs Clarice, he needs, you know, Beckendorf to be there to help him. That makes him incredibly relatable to me, just because I know I don't know everything, and I'm not always willing to admit it, but, like, it would probably be... I'd probably be much better off if I could admit that I don't know things.
Yeah.
But also, he has a set of skills, he has knowledge that is very valuable, and when he knows something, he's not afraid to put himself front and center and do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a particularly brave person, I don't think. Like, I'm not a Gryffindor. Just,
yeah.
And so I really value that in a character. Like, someone who has the bravery to put themselves, you know, in front of the bus or whatever it may be that they're dealing with. And so I really just, it makes me that much more fond of Percy because he has the ability to both be, like, weak and strong. Like, he knows his strengths and is willing to use those strengths to better everyone's life, but at the same time is like, I know my weaknesses too.
Yeah. You're right. It is very admirable.
Yeah. And then as far as, like, peripheral characters, because I have, there's certain ones where you just, you know, Tyson we've talked about.
Yeah.
And I could have just easily picked him and said, yes, he's my favorite, because I do love him dearly. But I also really love Beckendorf. We kind of, as we dissected Last Olympian,
mm-hmm.
my real affection toward Beckendorf kind of came to the forefront, and I really, really love him as a character. I love what he does for the story, and I'm really sad that we didn't get more of him, that we lost him so early in the entire chronicle, because I would have loved to have seen how he could have been beneficial to the group as a whole later.
Mm-hmm.
But also the Stoll brothers, because they're just trouble incarnate, and I love how they're just always up to no good and also good things. Like, they are not bad guys. They're just mischievous and
they're
crazy.
Chaotic.
Yeah. And so I love every time we get a Stoll brothers mention, and it's just a passing comment that makes me laugh, because it's like, we need that.
They add a lot of levity to the story.
Definitely.
In a way that's really needed sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be any surprise to anyone that Nico is my favorite character. I will say that Tyson is probably...
Yeah.
Tyson's probably a very close second, because I just remember every time, like, in Sea of Monsters, we were like, "Aw, Tyson." Like, every time he was on, we were like, "This is our favorite moment. This is our favorite line." Like, we just loved him so much.
And every time we checked in Last Olympian and we saw Tyson going, "Hey, brother!" Like,
yeah.
You just kind of are like... I love this creature with every fiber of my being. Like, I want to protect him.
Yeah, it's really hard not to love him. And I kind of feel the same way about Nico. Is like, it's, I just want to protect him. He's my little goth child. I love that for him. I love that he's broken and sad, because that's just, you know, how I feel, I guess. But... he's also incredibly powerful, and I love that dichotomy of somebody who's kind of a mess on the inside, but is, like, almost untouchable on the outside. And I think that his growth in the three books that we see him so far is so phenomenal. He starts off as this really happy, nerdy kid who gets his entire world, gets the entire Greek mythology world handed to him on a silver platter, and then the other half of his life, his sister, is snatched away from him. He's so integral to the story in terms of being a D'Angelo and Hades's kid and being all wrapped up in everything that's going on there. And he grows a lot on his own. I think that's one of my favorite things about him, is that he's not always in the middle of the action, and he definitely doesn't always do the right thing, thinking about when he tricks Percy into meeting with his dad and that does not go according to plan. But ultimately, like, he knows right from wrong. He might stumble a few times, but I feel like most of the time he already knows what the right answer is, and he's gonna do it at some point. And I just remember getting so excited every time he raised an army of the dead, or like he came strolling down Fifth Avenue with his dad. Like, oh, it's just so cool. Him and Mrs. O'Leary. Like, I am so excited for Heroes of Olympus when we get to see him more. And for The Son and the Star, like, I'm just beside myself, just so excited to see that, because I think he's a really incredible character and so important and iconic for having not been introduced until the third book. You know, I think that's pretty cool.
I don't think there's any doubt in anyone's mind that Nico is pivotal to the story being as beloved as it is. As much as we love Percy, Annabeth, and Grover, Nico's arrival and his story, even just through the end of Last Olympian, really does change. It changes the stakes for Percy. It changes, you know, like, there's so much that shifts once Nico comes on the scene. And he kind of becomes the plus one to the trio. Like, he's the fourth character. You know, as much as I think we all kind of imagine Clarice kind of is or was.
Or even Tyson in a lot of ways, too.
But I think Nico really is, he's the fourth character.
He's steadier, I think.
Well, he's got the most growth, I think, too. Yeah. As much as, like, Clarice has growth, it happens off camera. So, like, we don't necessarily see everything that's going on with Clarice. We see what's happened. We see her with Chris Rodriguez. We see Selena and how she's dealing with her.
I also think that Clarice didn't grow so much as Percy got to know her better. Like, she was kind of always that person, and then those layers are peeled back, whereas I feel like Nico, and, you know, Tyson is always kind of who he is, whereas Nico actually does grow a lot in these books.
Yeah, and that is definitely the other thing, is, like, Tyson is not a super complicated person. He knows what he values, and he sticks to it, and that is what it is. So, like, you don't have a ton of, like, character growth to really worry about with Tyson. When he shows up on the scene, you know what's going on.
Yeah, you know what to expect.
You know to cheer for him. You know, you know. But with Nico, kind of seeing him go from innocent child to troubled teen to, you know, more, and just watching it snowball into him accepting the whole being a child of Hades and what that means, and finding acceptance at Camp Half-Blood, and them kind of seeing him as an equal and as a friend, as opposed to just being that weirdo kid who hides out in the shadows all the time. So, like, yeah, I think Nico definitely is the fourth member of this trio. Like, he is the fourth biggest character, and he informs a lot of the story.
Yeah.
And will continue to. Yeah. As the books go on.
Definitely. So what are some of your favorite moments?
I mean, okay, I had to really fight to not just put all of my favorite Persebeth moments in here, because they really are my favorites. Like, I talked about in the last episode that we recorded, I talked about the moment in Sea of Monsters with Annabeth's vision, and I remember the underwater kiss and the scene in the volcano where she plants one on him and then runs away.
Yeah.
Like, those are some of my absolute favorite moments, because I just love watching them kind of figure it out, and getting to know each other and getting to know their feelings, getting in touch with their own feelings and figuring out what it all means. So, putting all that aside, I do have other favorite moments. I love the whole fight with Polyphemus, and I think the movie may still color a bit of what this is, because I do like how they did the action at the end of Sea of Monsters with the whole fight. Not the end fight, the fight with Polyphemus.
Right, right.
Sorry, not the end fight. The one with Polyphemus. Because I just, it's so nuanced. Like, them hanging on the sheep in the book.
Yeah.
This isn't in the movie. But, like, them hanging on the bellies of the sheep to get into the cave, and then the whole nobody thing.
Yeah.
And Grover having to be an intricate part of, like, yeah. I just, it's such a good fight scene. It's a little different than the straight up battle scenes. It's different than, like, losing Zoe and, like, all of that in Titan's Curse, yeah. And it's just different.
And Tyson gets a moment here, too, and really proves himself.
Yeah, he pops. He's not dead. He's alive. And, like, then he saves the day, and it's, yeah. So I really, really love the fight with Polyphemus. That's definitely on the top of my favorite moments. Also because we get a little dose of the hippocampi in there. And I love Rainbow, and every time we get to visit with Rainbow, it makes me happy. But the other one that sticks out in my head is Rachel and her hairbrush.
Yeah.
It's just only in a Percy Jackson book does throwing a hairbrush at the strongest god in the universe in human form, not god, Titan, throwing a hairbrush at him stuns him enough that you're able to get away.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen in other fantasy books. It doesn't happen in other stories like this. And, yeah, like, some of them, Hunger Games, take themselves too seriously. And some of them, Divergent, can't handle that kind of funny. And some of them, Harry Potter, aren't that imaginative. But then you get Rachel, who, she's a human and doesn't have a whole lot of power at her disposal. So her hairbrush in his eye is the best thing, you know, straight in the forehead, is the best thing she can think of. And it works. And they get away. So, yeah, I love that moment so much. It definitely sticks out.
Yeah. Man, to whoever's going to be playing Rachel down the line. Oh, I'm so excited for that.
That's such a big moment, and I can't wait.
Those are all really good. I should have asked, too, which, like, monsters were our favorite as well. I mean, I think we'd both probably be, like, Rainbow is the best creature. But, like, in terms of scariness, or just, like, I don't know, like, that's hard. Because I actually kind of really like the Minotaur. Like, I think that's just very classic.
Yeah, for sure. I like the Cyclopes. I like Polyphemus as a bad guy because we've got Tyson in the same book kind of representing the spectrum. So you've got the Cyclops that Annabeth has formed all of her opinions because of. Polyphemus, bad, whatever. Right. Then you've got Tyson, who's changing her mind on that and who is illustrating that Cyclopes are not all bad guys. And so I think I like Polyphemus as a monster because of that.
Yeah. I also like Medusa because I think that whole scene is really good. And how they end up, like, defeating her and stuff.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
It's the first one, too, so it just sticks out.
Yeah.
And, like, again, I like the Laydon, who they don't really fight, I guess. He's not really a monster, but, like, with Titan's Curse and how all of that goes on, like, meeting him and the dragon and all of that is really cool, too. So, I mean, that definitely ranks up there as well.
I think, in terms of my favorite moments, Percy sending Medusa's head to Olympus. Oh, so good. I'm glad that we're gonna get that. in the series, like in the show, first season, don't have to wait for it. Don't have to worry that it'll never come to our screens. It's definitely going to be there. So yeah. That makes me really, really excited. And yeah, anytime Nico is Lord of the Dead, because all hail the Ghost King. Every time I just get like these butterflies in my chest. And having reread this book several times, the fact that it can still make me feel that way, I think, really says something. So
yeah.
It's very, very exciting. Mm. Also, I'm retracting all of my answers. Sorry, Rainbow. Mrs. O'Leary's my favorite.
I mean, it's hard to remember all of them.
Yes, it is.
But no, she's an absolute delight as yeah. well.
So what about some of your favorite quotes? You know, we've been quoting these books ever since we started reading them. There's a ton of graphics up on the Instagram, which is very helpful because I scrolled through them to figure out which ones were my favorite. Which ones stood out to you?
Well, as I was kind of like, I was just trying to think of specific moments that I know there's a line that I'm like, what was the, you know, what was the one that I can't think of? Mm-hmm. And then I went and looked it up and found it. So one of my favorite moments is Percy coming back from, this is in Battle of the Labyrinth, Percy coming back from Calypso, having been gone for 2 weeks, they're burying him, think he's dead, and he shows up, and Annabeth yells, "Where have you been? We thought you were dead, seaweed brain." And Percy says, "I'm sorry, I got lost." And she goes, "Lost?" Like, just the absolute incredulity of Annabeth. Like, listen, Percy, there is no excuse you can give me that will make this okay. You have wronged me, and you shall suffer. Like, it's just like, I love seeing, you know, and it's a very complicated scene after this as she kind of gets an inkling of what happened and Chiron kind of stops, you know, tries to pull Percy aside because of all of that. But the actual, just the moment where she sees him and just starts yelling at him, it's because she's already just clinging to her Percy. She does love him at that point. You know, it might be more like friendship love. It's not romantic love yet, but it's an attachment, and it's just makes it really a great moment. I also had to throw in, because I don't think I did a graphic for this on the Instagram, but it's that Grover moment from The Last Olympian where they're on the elevator and he says, "Well, sure, good to be together again. Arguing. Almost dying. Abject terror. Oh, look, it's our floor." Like, it's just so indicative of the spirit of these books. Like, yes, they might be facing death every other day. Yes, they're demigods who may not make it past their teen years, and that would be totally on par with demigods of the world, you know, for decades. And, yeah, they have to face all this stuff because there's nobody else to, but they're still children, it's still fun, and we're gonna have fun with this story. So, yeah, it's definitely up there.
I really love Grover's moments of, like, sass, because yeah. he doesn't have them too often, but he chooses the perfect time yeah. to use that, and I think that he's a little bit outside of what keeps going on between Annabeth and Percy, and yeah, he's really funny, and like I said, I keep picturing Arian, and I'm so excited to see him deliver those lines.
Yeah. And I tell you, I usually, when I'm looking for quotes, when I know there's 10 million that I want to choose, I usually just, like, Google it and click on the Goodreads link and go through all of the Goodreads quotes that are there. And there was a Percibeth quote that I almost chose because I don't know if we, like, really talked about it or if it was one of our favorite quotes. So I'm gonna say it now because I can't help myself. It was, "The world was collapsing and the only thing that really mattered to me was that she was alive." And it's just, it's so
nice,
right? Like, it shows just how much Percy and Annabeth's bond has, like, completely formed. Like, there's no gray area there. She is definitely one, you know, her mother, his mother, Grover, these are the people who are most important to him in the world. And yeah, that when I first read that, just scrolling through, I was like, oh. And I was, again, trying to steer clear of Persebeth stuff because we already kind of talked about all that. But yeah, that one just, I can't help myself.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many great quotes from these books. Obviously, we pick like two per chapter
right.
every week, and we've been doing this for five books, so...
And sometimes there's too many to choose from.
Yeah, and sometimes we pick more than just two, right. and yeah, they're so, so good. I kind of went back to the classics because the ones that I can, like, recall from memory, those are the ones that kind of have impacted me the most. So I think, look, I didn't want to be a half-blood like that one. And the end of the world started when a Pegasus landed on the hood of my car. We've talked a bunch of times about the way that Rick can really just grab you with that first sentence. And I really loved that. Those two have the same vibe to me. And I like that they were, like, you know, book one and book five.
Mm-hmm.
I had to shout out, her name is Annabeth, and she's one of a kind, even though that's not technically from one of the books.
So good.
But it is really good, and I think that one is really going to stay with me for a while. I also, because we were talking about the Medusa scene, had to bring up, they're not going to like that, Grover warned. They'll think you're impertinent. And Percy just goes, I am impertinent. That's a very classic Percy line and vibe. So I really liked that.
I was going to say, another classic that it's in, you can't touch it. With great power comes great need to take a nap. Wake me up later. Like, it's just, it just is. There's so many good ones.
Yeah.
Even taking all the Persebeth ones out because we've already touched on so many of those. Because they usually stick out in my brain, you know, as we're reading the chapter, it's like, oh, it's definitely that one because it's them. But yeah, even taking them out, there's still so many where you're like, how do I choose?
Yeah, they're really great. So kind of wrapping this up soon, I wanted to know if there were like anything, okay, because we've both read this series multiple times, but this is the first time that we've both really taken our time to, like, discuss it and dive into it. So did you have any changes of heart, or were there any surprises from rereading the series?
Two things for me. First, we've already kind of talked about it, the amount of time that Annabeth and Percy spend apart in the first series. It just never occurred to me that they actually, words on page, time in story, spend a lot of time apart because she's mad at him or she's kidnapped or he has to go with Nico to do this thing. So, like, we really don't get as much time with them together in those books as I thought that we did. And I know that with Heroes of Olympus, when we finally get to them, like, it's them together, like, all the time, and it's going to heal my shipper heart. But yeah, that definitely stood out to me reading it this time because we had the time to kind of feel that separation with doing two chapters and then one chapter. Like, doing it a little bit at a time and really letting the story, you know, unfold. We got to really feel how long some of these things went on for. And so yeah, that just really jumped out at me. But the other thing is my fondness for Nico. I have always liked Nico, just generally, but he was never, like, my favorite, or he wasn't somebody that I particularly, like, identified with super strongly.
Right.
He had some moments where I was like, ooh, I feel that. Yeah. Like, yeah, I get that, Nico. Yeah, absolutely. But in this read-through, I really saw just how far he's come, not only from little kid to, like, basically grown-ass adult at, like, you know, in, like, 3 years or something.
He go through a lot in a short amount of time.
He changes from being this innocent child to a completely battered, destroyed human being. And then by the end of The Last Olympian is healing.
Yeah.
He's not healed, but you can see the progress even from, Bianca's death and being absolutely destroyed by it and everything that that does to him. You start to see him heal. You start to see him put things together and come, you know, he learns that not everyone is going to be truthful, and he learns that he has to be careful, and he comes to the rescue, and people see him as a hero, and yeah. So I think getting into Nico's story and really breaking it down, was a really valuable thing for me in this read-through. And it makes me that much more excited for The Son and the Star, because I'm ready to see the evolution of Nico. Like, I want to see him happy.
Yeah.
Like, happy, yeah. Not just like, oh, they don't hate me happy. Like, I want to see him, you know, have some moment. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of sadness and mm-hmm. other things. But I have a feeling we're also going to get to see him happy, and that makes me really happy.
Yeah. Yeah. I was kind of surprised in a few different places with my, like, reading and interpretation of the books. I think, again, I was kind of surprised that I didn't like The Last Olympian as much as I thought I would. Just the first half of the book, to me, was really frustrating in terms of Annabeth and Percy not talking, which is, like, obviously the point, but doesn't mean I had to like it.
Yeah.
And just, like, a few other things like that, I was just a little frustrated with the direction that it had to go in just to, like, get the story out there. But on the positive side, like, I love Clarice way more now. Like, she is a way more complicated, complex, interesting character than I realized when I first read this series. And so I'm so excited to see what she's like in the show, because I think Dior's going to do a fantastic job of bringing that to the screen. I feel like Annabeth is a little more flawed than I remembered her being, but I think that's a good thing. Like, I think that it's so important to have flawed characters. And for her, because she's so smart and she's so capable, she's such a great warrior, she's a good friend. Like, there had to be something wrong with her. And, like, you know, that's kind of a funny thing to say, but she can't be perfect. And I think her having, you know, hubris as her fatal flaw is very interesting to me. Her having these prejudices at first against Tyson is very interesting to me. And I think she grew a lot in the books as well, and her relationship with Percy grew a lot. And that's much more interesting and dynamic than if she had just been Annabeth the whole time, you know?
I think another thing, and this is just off the cuff as we're talking here, I think her relationship with Chiron was another thing that I don't think I really... Like, of course he's their mentor. He's all of their mentor. But I think really seeing them as, like, she's been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And he's become the father figure that her dad, you know, as much as she wishes he was more present, especially at the beginning of the series, she doesn't really have that. So Chiron kind of steps in and takes that role. And they bond so much. Like, they are a duo all their own. Mm-hmm. He trusts her to take care of Percy in the big house right at the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
Like, entrusts Percy's care to her and knows she'll be, you know, he'll be fine. She's got it. Like, I think that is another relationship that I didn't notice the first time I read it. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously I saw them, but I didn't really notice just how, like, caring and loving their relationship really is.
I feel the same way about Annabeth and Clarice. Like, I had forgotten they actually become friends, and, like, they're on a level with each other that, like, Percy isn't with Clarice, and I find that very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that kind of surprised me this time around was how dark Rick goes in some places, and I think that it's really important to have those types of stories in books like this for children to read. You know, everything that happens with Nico is incredibly tragic, but I'm glad that it's on the page, because if somebody did lose a sibling, they can kind of work through that while watching Nico work through that. I feel like that's really important. I will say that Aries potentially being physically abusive to Clarice really shocked me, and it not being addressed still kind of surprises me. And I guess we don't get, like, confirmation of it necessarily, but the way that she flinches around him and stuff, you can tell that he's obviously a very physical person. And I do wish that that was one of the things that was kind of addressed, and I'm curious, like, moving forward if we get more of that or what. But, yeah, I mean, the adult moments in this book still kind of take me by surprise, because it's obviously for younger kids. Starts off for, like, 12-year-olds, basically. I think 9 to 12 might be the age range for
middle grade,
books.
That sounds about right.
But as adults, as people in our 30s, being able to read it and, like, see beyond that and, like, see the adult issues that he's tackling is, like, it surprises me every time, and I'm really grateful every time for the way that he wrote these books.
Agreed. Very, very much agreed.
All right, last question. Based on what we read in Percy Jackson and the Olympians, what are you looking forward to seeing more of in Heroes of Olympus?
My very first instinct when I read this, I mean, besides Persebeth, it's always my first instinct.
I mean, that was my first instinct.
I just love them, and yeah. I want to see them, and yeah. I want to see them happy, I want to see them complicated, I want to see all the things. No, my other first instinct is to say new characters, because I really do think Rick introduces new characters so well.
That's true.
When Talia steps into the scene, it changes everything. When Tyson steps into the scene, it changes everything.
Yeah.
Nico changes the entire end of that book. I feel like meeting all the new Heroes of Olympus characters really does just widen this world even more than it already is, and I am looking forward to that for sure. But I do have a couple of other things as well. Rachel stepping into the role of Oracle at the end of Last Olympian, like, we're just barely scratching the surface with what this means for her and how it's going to change her everyday life, her summers, her, you know. So I'm really, really looking forward to kind of paying more attention to Rachel as the Oracle. I think in the past, I've just kind of let those chapters, like, go by because I wasn't like as invested in Rachel's story as I was in the questing party, like, right. You know, in figuring out the mystery and all of that right. kind of stuff. But I am really interested to see and really pay attention to Rachel's story and just seeing her adapt to camp life as well. And like adapting to Greek. I think she's a really interesting character to kind of use as the human entrance to the story. Like, we all saw the story through Percy because he was entering the world at that point. But in Heroes of Olympus, like, she's just been introduced to this at the end of Last Olympian. So, like, in Heroes of Olympus, I'll be interested to see how she's adapted.
Yeah, for sure. I think I feel very much the same way you do. Like, Persebeth was my first instinct for sure, because we talked specifically about not really seeing them together as a couple. They didn't become a couple until, like, the last chapter of the book, so
yeah.
There's a lot more there that I want to dive into. I think Rachel is also, kind of for the same reason, a really good choice for this question, because yeah, like, she's human. You know, she's not a demigod, and yet she's thrust into this world. And more than that, she has this, like, crazy power
yeah.
that, like, nobody else does. Literally, she's the only one who really has this much of the Oracle in her.
And has for decades. Nobody's had this
yeah.
power, so nobody really knows.
Nobody can really tell her, except for, like, Apollo, maybe, or, like, people who remember the Oracle when the Oracle was still alive.
Like, but maybe Chiron.
Yeah, but even that's gonna be kind of tough, you
yeah.
know? So she's in a very, very unique position in this series and in this world. I think, other than that, obviously, I want to see more of Nico's trajectory. I feel like he's really just starting to get his feet under him by the end of the books, and bringing in Will Solace, and just, you know, knowing what I know will happen to Nico in Heroes of Olympus, I'm very interested to kind of revisit that and see what happens and see how much he grows again. I want more Greek mythology. Like, I've really been enjoying exploring the gods and talking about them so in depth and the different stories and everything. And I know that Heroes of Olympus kind of goes global. And we're introduced to Camp Jupiter. And like you were saying, all of the new characters, like Leo and Piper and Reyna, like, they're
Jason.
All, yeah, they're
yeah.
all classic characters that you don't get until the second series. And it's like, wow. You know, this world, which has expanded with each and every book, gets even bigger in Heroes of Olympus, and especially, like, the way that they get to travel and how it goes global. I think I'm very, very interested in all of that. So,
yeah.
There's a lot to look forward to.
For sure. And now we're going to completely abandon everything
yes.
and go talk about Egypt.
Yeah.
It's true. Like, these are all things I'm looking forward to, and it may be a year, 2 years in the future. By the time we finish all of the King Chronicles books, like, it'll be a little while. But I'm still looking forward to all these things.
I know. It's hard to wait because I'm super, super excited for King Chronicles. But I also want to jump right into Heroes of Olympus. And I want to do it one chapter at a time because I feel like we have way better discussions that way.
Yeah.
But it's just like, I guess the good thing too is at least King Chronicles is only 3 books. So it's not quite as long.
And it is a new adventure for me because I have not read them. So it's a very different kind of thing than rereading a series I already know what's going to happen.
I wonder how much I'm going to remember because I think it's going to be very little.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts as well. Tune in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and more. We also have Not About the Weather. It's a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And lastly, Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the movie, and Jeff Davis's new show, Wolfpack, is currently getting the same treatment. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help other people to find us, and that is always a huge help. You can leave us questions or comments or ideas for episodes you want to hear from us in any of these places. We're always glad to get an idea of what you guys want to hear us talk about. We do have some feedback this week. I know Karen threw some questions out on Twitter based on our retrospective on the whole book thing, and I think she got a response or two.
Yeah, Nicholas responded to us at Mon Nicholas, and he was just basically I was asking everybody the same questions that I asked us, which was, you know, what's your favorite book, what's your favorite character, all that kind of stuff. So Nicholas says, I think my favorite books, either The Lightning Thief or The Battle of the Labyrinth, which I agree. Former is the one I've reread the most, but the latter was maybe more memorable considering I've read it fewer. Character is probably Tyson. He's eternally supportive, although Nico changes so much throughout the series that he's interesting to follow. This is great. You should come on a podcast.
Karen's like, agrees with me?
You can just replace me. He also says, I'm not good with remembering quotes, but maybe with great power comes great need to take a nap. It's gotten stuck in my head now, and it's one of the few references I 100% understood since my first read.
It's a solid one.
And lastly, if it counts as a moment rather than a whole scene, the battle against the Nemean lion in the Smithsonian Museum, because I love picturing it, maybe the moment in Titan's Curse where Mr. D calls Percy by his real name, a lot of possibilities are going through my head. I have to say, the Nemean lion is a very good one. Mm-hmm. That's one that, like, I feel like I can visualize it pretty easily. And also, anytime Mr. D lets down his walls. Yeah. I kind of forgot about Mr. D, to be perfectly honest, because I remember, especially earlier in the books, going, wow, Mr. D is great. Like, I actually really like him. Even though he's a pain in the butt a lot, I think that he truly means well, and I love a grumpy person who's secretly a marshmallow.
He plays a smaller role in those last 2 books?
Yeah, he really does.
Yeah, like, those first 2, he's present, he's around, he's, you know, driving Percy crazy. So, you know, that's all kind of invested. But by the end of the story, Mr. D isn't really around, so I think we do kind of lose track of him a little bit. But still, it doesn't make him any less fun.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so that brings us to next week. Next week, we're going to start the Kane Chronicles.
Yeah!
And we're going to transition to be all Egypt, all the time.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm definitely interested to, like, read a brand new Rick Riordan book that I haven't read. Like, I feel like such a slacker. I'm so sorry. To all of you true Riordan fans who have read all of these and I've failed you. I think it'll be interesting Because you have read them, or at least, have you read
two of three? Yeah.
So, like, you have a good idea of what's happening and going to happen, and I have no clue.
Yeah.
Like, all this time, I am not spoiled on anything. Like, I don't really know anything about the characters.
That's pretty cool.
Right? So, yeah. I'm honestly really excited to kind of see how it feels to kind of go through that dynamic. Because eventually, we'll get back to Heroes of Olympus, where we both know what's going to happen. We both read the books. We both know everything. Yeah. So it's like we can get back to what we've been doing all along. But I think this will be an interesting, fun little side project.
Yeah, I think so too, because I read the first two as they came out, and I don't think I've reread them. So I've only read them once years ago when they first came out. So this is definitely going to be an adventure, but I think it'll make our discussion more interesting because we won't be like, yeah, we know what's gonna happen. We'll be like, wait, here's all of our theories.
Kristen's surprised by everything every week. It's gonna be so much fun.
Yeah.
Okay, so yes, read Red Pyramid Chapter 1 for next week, and we're gonna do an Egyptian gods overview, so I get a general idea of who does what and who is
just the main players, to kind of ease ourselves into Egyptian mythology.
I'm definitely looking forward to that because I have some pop culture knowledge of Egyptian gods from movies like The Mummy or Night at the Museum or little things, right. But I don't have a really strong knowledge of all the gods of the Egyptian pantheon. Yeah, it's something I'm definitely looking forward to diving into, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Hope so.
Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.